Hello and a very warm welcome to Quadriga, coming to you from the heart of Berlin. And this week we are focusing on the growing international row over the United Nations Migration Pact. The document, due to be adopted next month, aims to provide a framework for safe, orderly and regular migration. That has to be a good thing for the many millions of people on the move across the world, but it's already triggered fierce debate. Indeed, the US, Australia, Israel and a number of European countries say they won't be endorsing the agreement, which they see as an infringement of their sovereignty, leading to further mass migration. So our question here on Quadriga this week is, pact or panic, can migration be controlled? And to discuss that question, I'm joined here in the studio by three astute observers and analysts, beginning with Ana Alvarez, founder and CEO of Migration Hub. That's a network supporting social projects working with migrants. And Ana argues that we should take the pact as a starting point for future cooperation and civil society engagement. Beware, though, she says, the politicians' alarming narrative. Also with us is Matthew Karnichnik, chief Europe correspondent with Politico, who argues that, unfortunately, populists have poisoned the debate to such an extent that the facts about it don't matter. And a warm welcome, too, to Deutsche Welle's own Edith Kimani, who is a presenter and correspondent with DW based here in Berlin. And Edith says migration is as natural as the flow of rivers. We can channel it, slow it down, dam it up, but it will always be on the move. The pact is an acknowledgement of the inevitable. And Ana, I'd like to begin with you, if I might. The pact, everybody's talking about it. It's due to be endorsed in Marrakesh, Morocco, in just about 2 weeks' time. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described it as a truly historic agreement. What makes it so important?
What makes it so important is that for the first time, everyone agreed back in 2016 that it was a topic that needed to be discussed, right? Of course, because of recent situations happening with the so-called crisis in 2015 that hit Europe. So we have to look at it historically because of that, and also because back then, so it's been 18 months that the leader states, so all the members, the 193 countries, they had the opportunity to have open and wide discussions with the civil society.
Okay, those are the states, those are the countries behind this, but the real question is, I mean, you come into contact with migrants on a daily basis, effectively. How will it affect their lives?
It doesn't affect their lives. First of all, they don't know about this, because at the end of the day, what you read on and through the 23 points of the Global Compact are things that should have been already established. I mean, we should dignify migrants wherever they go, number one. And number two, there has been lots of wider discussions in the civil society, right? So I guess this is a call to the member states to always include the migrant perspective.
Mm. And Edith, migration is undoubtedly a defining issue of our global linked world at the moment.
Definitely.
You call the pact an acknowledgement of the inevitable. What do you mean by that?
Basically, just what Ana said, that this is something that has been happening for decades. It's only now that the world is finally sitting down and saying, hey, we need a document that gives us a framework on how to work around this. And it's too late. I mean, it's coming really quite late. And the 2015 crisis is obviously what exacerbated it. But in my opinion, this is a conversation that should have been happening at least 10 years before 2015.
You say it's too late. You say it should have happened a decade ago. It's been described by its critics as toothless and non-binding, a non-binding compromise. Tell me more.
Non-binding is better than nothing, in my opinion, because, again, going back to where the migrants are coming from, it first of all acknowledges them as human beings, because what this document is trying to do is establish a communication framework between the migrants and between the host countries. Why are you here? What can we do for you? And how do we make it so that you are able to go back to your countries? It opens up that dialogue.
If all this is so obvious, why has it come so late?
That's the question I've been asking, and that's why I'm saying that it should have happened at least 10 years before. I believe it's because Europe was finally forced to face this in 2015. Migration has been happening in the Southern Hemisphere for a very, very long time, and I don't know if there are any kinds of frameworks such as this one, but when the ships started docking on the Mediterranean seas, then the Europeans thought, wow, we need to start doing something about this now.
Matthew, the pact is toothless, non-binding, and it has also come out of the blue and been badly communicated.
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I think that a lot of people haven't been paying attention to what the UN has been talking about over the last couple of years, and maybe the media is partly to blame for that. The populists, especially in Europe, haven't been asleep at the switch, and they quickly seized onto this agreement and have made it really appear to be something that it's not. I would actually say that migration, it hasn't just been an issue for decades. I would say it's been an issue for hundreds of years. It's been a reality for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years. It's always been something that the world has had to deal with in various ways. And this latest discussion, I think, is just a way to focus attention on it. And it was obviously driven by what happened in 2015. But it reminds me a little bit of the Kyoto Protocol back in the early 1990s, where the global community said, this is an issue that we need to pay more attention to. We need to devote more resources about it to it, and we need to have serious discussions about it. So while it might be toothless, yes, on the other hand, it does establish basic standards that most countries, including Germany and most European countries, are adhering to anyway.
Anna.
Well, actually, what I would like to say regarding toothless and why the critics are saying this is because it doesn't bring up real mechanisms how to tackle the issue, right? I mean, many, many critics around this, they're saying, okay, so how do we do it? Is the main question. So we deal with migration, how do we do it, right? So when you have a document which is largely vague and wants to be a global issue to be discussed, is still we lack of the mechanisms and how do we do it? So let's discuss internally about these integrations, which I would like to include it. I would like to say it about inclusion. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the inclusion mm-hmm. process of migrants, right? And perhaps many were waiting that this global compact would have said how this process should look like or where to get the best practices, which definitely not in Europe.
I think that the concept of dealing with migration is already defeatist. How do we deal...
The concept of dealing with migration has already been defeated.
Yeah, because what are we dealing with exactly? The movement of people? We've already heard from Matthew that this has always happened and it will continue to happen. Mm. So perhaps we need to change the language and figure out how to deal with irregular migration, which we then call illegal. And I don't know what people in your industry say about that, but I have a big problem with that.
Well, critics on the right would say you're moving from illegal to irregular. You're making it less easy to prevent people from coming to the prosperous West.
No, if anything, I am saying that we should start looking at why these people are moving in the first place, as opposed to trying to deal with their movement after the fact. And that's where I think the language would really be helpful.
It's interesting. Matthew, you're talking about it being part of the human experience throughout history, migration, people on the move. The Vision and Guiding Principles section of the Pact actually mentioned that, and it says it is a source of prosperity, innovation and sustainable development. Why is it then a problem? Why is migration a problem at all? Why is it being addressed as a problem? Or is that the paradigm shift that we're now seeing?
It's been seen a problem, and actually the right wing is taking advantage of that. And that's also why I said we have to beware. In fact, if there's no country agreeing with this global compact, then we have to look internally into us. If we don't want a dignifying and a safe migration pathways for all the people on the move, who are we as a humanity, right? So let's take a look on the people who are denying this and are opposed to this. So it is definitely a narrative. And the populists are using migration these days because it is decreasing. The migration flows are decreasing in Europe and even in the United States.
Well, and I think it also, if we're honest, it is a challenge for societies to deal with large influxes of migrants. And this has also always been the case. It's been the case in the United States. If you look back over the centuries, the waves of migrants that came to the United States from Italy, from Ireland and places, it was always controversial for a while. There was always racism and there were always attacks on the migrants because there was a sense that too many of them were coming at once. And this is what you're feeling in Europe at the moment. But I think there's too little focus on the benefits of migration over time to countries, and especially in Europe, which is aging very rapidly. They're going to need a younger population to support many of the systems that people, have become used to here, all of the social programs and so forth. And I think that there's too little discussion about that. There's a lot of discussion about the downsides, the dangers and so forth, and there's a lot of discussion about integration. But I think, the real problem in Europe especially in Germany, I think, at the moment, is that there's this sense that you can integrate people and that nothing is going to change in society, that Germany is going to stay just as it is. And that's not the case. And integration does change societies. Most people would argue, many people would argue, for the better, but it's inevitable. And I think this sense that the populists are sort of projecting now that, well, if we manage migration, if we prevent migration, then these changes won't occur is just completely unrealistic.
Okay. Well, thank you for all that. You mentioned the United States, Matthew. Let's go to what is currently one of the world's most visible migration hotspots, the city of Tijuana on the U.S.-Mexican border, where thousands of Central Americans, mainly from Honduras and Guatemala, are hoping to make their way to the U.S. But President Trump says they won't be allowed in, and among the local Mexican population, signs of aggression towards the migrants.
Mexicans are protesting against refugees passing through their country, louder and louder. Beat it! We don't want you, they yell. Get out! Many of the local population see the migrants as an expensive burden and a threat. They sound much like U.S. President Trump. They label the migrant caravan an invasion. The migrants sleep in improvised shelters. To keep tensions down, the authorities have imposed a curfew.
They have every right to protest. They don't want us here. But even so, the Mexicans are good people. They're like us. And we're just passing through. We don't want to stay.
But they know what to expect at the United States border. Can the UN Migration Compact keep people from fleeing their homes?
That's an interesting question. But Ana Alvarez, what I'd like to ask you is, as somebody from the region, what thoughts go through your head when you see those reports and those scenes from the border in Tijuana?
It's, I guess, as a humanity, we have arrived to a peak of lack of empathy. You know that for many of them, they're fleeing out terrible and violent backgrounds. So they are asylum seekers. And in order to seek for an asylum in the United States, you have to be in their lands. So forbidding them, it's totally inhuman and even against the law. So what are we talking about here, right? We should actually reframe, and this is something that in the Global Compact and perhaps the discussions should be a starting point from now on. For example, let's define who are migrants. Let's define who are refugees. Refugees are not only the ones who are escaping war, are the ones who are escaping danger. People from Central America are escaping danger. They are prosecuted, but they are not recognized as refugees, for instance, right? So these are what is called the aspiring migrants. And they have rights, and we should protect them. Mm.
And Edith, what goes through your head then, given what Ana has just been saying, when you hear those Mexicans there saying, get lost, beat it, get away, we don't want you here?
I'm completely heartbroken because I have interviewed people who have been on the boats from Africa trying to get into Europe, and they have put themselves through the most difficult, most dangerous situations. And they don't want to be doing that. And we know this because since the talks began between Eritrea and Ethiopia on peace building, the number of migrants has reduced from those countries. And it shows that they're not going voluntarily. They would rather not, actually. So to hear other people receive them as though they are nothing, not human beings, in fact, that's what it does. It eliminates the dignity, but it also makes migrants objects. Mm. They're just passing things. And that, for me, is truly heartbreaking.
Mm. The mayor of Tijuana said people should be given their dignity. Their dignity should be self-evident. Is that what the pact is going to achieve?
It's what it aspires to do, at least on paper. That's what it looks like. Mm. And the big dialogue, of course, or rather the big conversation, has been on how to implement it, particularly on a country-to-country basis. Because what Germany thinks is dignified might not be what Kenya, for example, thinks is dignified. And these are some of the blind spots and perhaps the loopholes that the document has that might need to be addressed in the future. But like Ana, I do agree that it's a starting point. It's a great place to begin.
Mm. And when you talk about the interviews that you've had, for example, the access you've had to the story, would you say that there's a I know it's very difficult to generalize because Africa has got so many people who are coming to Europe to start better lives, but many African countries are also host countries. So yeah. I'm wondering, is there an African perspective on all this that we're talking about today?
Well, Africans are very
obsessed. Very global question, I know.
Yeah, but not to generalize or anything, but the general sentiment is that of anger and despondence, actually, because Africans have been left out of this conversation on migration for a very long time. It's only post-2015 that the world suddenly realises an entire continent that's also contributing to the flow of migrants that needs to be put to the table, that needs to be brought into the conversation. So they were brought in a little too late. And often when the conversation of migration comes up in the context of Africa, it's always those people who are trying to come in. How do you keep them on the continent? That's usually the frame of the narrative. So you can understand why I'm also quite upset about that.
Yeah. Do people have an automatic human right to migrate?
I don't think you should be asking me, because I'm a beneficiary of migration to begin with. What I do.
Me too, ultimately. Yeah. that's the ironic thing. Yeah.
I do believe that every country has its power for sovereignty. I mean, they do determine who gets in and out of their borders. But just based on humanity, come on, people are fleeing war, they're fleeing disease, they're fleeing bad economic situations. And to turn them away without the benefit of even assessing their situation is unacceptable.
Mm-hmm. Matthew, what would you say? Do people have a right to migrate? Do countries have, at the same time, a right to say to people no and turn them back and send them home?
I think they do, and they exercise that right. And all of these countries have a legal framework for dealing with these issues. Germany does. Every European country does. The United States does. I think, though, that we also should recognize the fact that a lot of countries benefit from what is, referred to as illegal migration. And where I come from, I grew up near that border in Arizona, and there was a constant flow of illegal migrants, illegal aliens, as we called them, coming over the border. Particularly for the harvest, they would work in the fields and earn some money, and then go back to Mexico or farther south. And this was completely normal, and both sides benefited from it. I think what has changed now is that populists, in particular, are using this issue to create these deep divides in the society, and to imply that this is a danger to the societies in the West, when it's always been there. Not only has it always happened, but the societies have benefited.
Why is it happening now? Why is the argument suddenly so lopsided? Given that we know that 3.4% of the global population are migrants, and they generate 10% of global GDP. Mm-hmm. These are known facts.
Well, I think one factor in Europe is which isn't often discussed is the element of Islam. The linkage that we've seen, the fears of terrorism, a lot of Muslims coming into predominantly Christian areas, I think that is what has unnerved a lot of people and has made this latest wave somewhat different, say, than what happened in the 1990s, where you had the disintegration of Yugoslavia and a lot of people coming up from Yugoslavia. And I think in the United States, the difference is that previously when migrants came, they were limited to a few areas in the southwest of the United States, where I'm from. They didn't tend to disperse into the rest of the country. And that has changed in recent years. And Trump has recognized that, this is something that has unnerved a lot of people, especially in rural communities where, they were pretty homogenous over decades or over hundreds of years, and all of a sudden they have little pockets of South Americans living on the edge of town, this is a change, but I think people need to accept that there are benefits from it. The cheap labor that the migrants offer is something that all Western societies have benefited greatly from.
Cheap labour and very often very skilled people. Yeah, as we have seen, the international community will be meeting in Morocco shortly to ratify the Global Compact for safe, orderly and regular migration. At least that is the idea. But there's suddenly a growing list of nations who are changing their minds and heading for the door.
The United Nations began negotiating its migration compact in 2016. The United States never took part.
Last July, the first to bail out was Australia, and then Hungary.
The government considers the UN Global Compact on Migration as dangerous for the entire world because it inspires millions to leave their homes.
Shortly afterwards, Austria declared that it would not be signing the compact because the term migration was still too fuzzy. Then Bulgaria opted out, stating that the compact would endanger national interest. Poland followed suit.
We believe that the Marrakesh Agreement is not a solution for the migration crisis. On the contrary, it would only intensify the crisis.
Czechia is withholding its signature too. I don't like this compact, says Czech Prime Minister Andrej Babiš. Israel, Croatia, and Slovakia too. Almost every day, another country opts out. Is the criticism of the compact justified?
It's called a global compact for migration, Edith. How important is that preposition, for?
Depends who's reading it. Like Anna said, if the migrants are unaware of this, then it makes no difference. It's just a high-level conversation happening between governments. It needs to really trickle down to the people who are affected for those migrants. Because at the moment, the conversation has been hijacked, as Matthew said, by the far right. And we're focusing on what they are saying, trying to correct their erroneous statements, as opposed to really listening to the migrants and figuring out what works for you.
But what is the argument to the far right? We had the Hungarian, the foreign minister in that report saying it will inspire millions of people to get on the move.
Oh, well, that's just outright propaganda. I am here in Germany voluntarily. I have choice and agency. I wasn't brought here by war or disease. And it's still a difficult transition. It's not easy to live in a country that's not yours. I just don't see how millions of people could one day decide, oh, now that there's this global compact, I now want to go live in Hungary. No. And that just goes back to my initial point of exclusion of the actual migrants. They don't know what's bringing them here, so they can't possibly know what will keep them away.
What I really like about the Global Compact is, as I said at the beginning, the potential it has to start a discussion. At least I have been personally invited, even my organization hosted March this year, a Global Compact consultation to the civil society and migrant-led organizations, which was led by two big, larger foundations that belongs to a company. So if members of the civil society, which are not necessarily the government, are fostering this discussion, then this is the moment to engage states, and this is the moment to engage the larger organizations as well to open the discussion. We have to include more migrants, more regular migrants, the ones who are in the streets, the ones who are not being entrepreneurs or owning their own organization. We need to invite them to discuss this. What you were saying about integration, how does integration look like? How this affects a society? It does, for the better, definitely. But we see in Europe a resistance to the change, to be open to new cultures, to be open to new opportunities.
Do you see a resistance to change in Germany?
Well, I have seen a shift in the last 2 years, ever since I arrived, and people were welcoming, especially the ones who were fleeing out from the Middle East back then. And who are they right now, right? Many of them, many projects have been created, but you have seen a shift in the narrative. You have seen the only fact that AfD exists today and it's growing in every region where people are voting, that is telling you something.
Three important elections next year as well.
Absolutely. They, yeah. And other countries like Canada, for instance, as well, they're going to elections, and they're also are afraid that migration is also going to be a topic. But we need to discuss about the benefits that migration brings. I was sharing earlier that in the United States, actually, it was not publicly and widely discussed, that in the last decade, only from the ones who have refugee status, they contributed to the state. In other words, they left $63 billion in revenues, only with the ones who have a legal status or refugee status. What about the ones that we are not tracking, the remittances, for instance, the ones that we're not tracking their incomes? So I guess that the Global Compact could be an interesting starting point to open the discussion and talk about the benefits instead of thinking that this is going to welcome more migrants.
Edith, I'm interested in your final thoughts. We're running out of time. The question we set at the beginning of the show was, can migration be controlled? Yeah. OK, so I'd like to ask you a double question resulting from that. Can migration be controlled? Should migration be controlled?
Can migration be controlled? I think not. I think it can be regulated. Should it be regulated? Definitely. And I think in the conversation about regulation, the powerful should also have a conversation with themselves. Who's checking the Western nations that are sending arms to these countries, who are supporting less than democratic nations, which is then resulting in this flow of migration?
OK, thank you very much for those final thoughts. Thank you all three for being here, Matthew, Anna and Edith. That was the latest edition of Quadriga. If you've enjoyed the show and had plenty of food for thought, which I hope is the case, join us next week. Until then, bye-bye and tschüss.